Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. It's Monday. It's April 11th and 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And I'm already speaking to John Bailey, who's waiting on the line. And he told me about something that happened 120 years ago. So first of all, good morning, John. How are you?
Good morning, world.
Well, I'm glad that you pointed out that historical event. I had no idea it's been 120 years. I don't remember what happened.
Yeah,
the movie was not that terrific either, but 120 years and a day. Wow.
Yes. Well, the reason we need to remember the Titanic is the folly of human expectations.
Yes, that's right. I never thought of it that way, but you're 100% right.
It was a totally preventable tragedy, and it was recklessness, carelessness, and inconsideration for the paying passengers that caused that horrible disaster.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not enough lifeboats. Too fast, running in ice lanes, and the captain not being on deck.
Is very interesting, but it's amazing that it's made an impact even to this day, 120 years later. And I think the movie, even though the movie wasn't as tragic as the incident itself, it did bring it back. It's like it reminded us of a history where too many people cut corners. And we do to this day.
Cutting corners today. Boeing cuts corners.
Yeah.
Boeing, how can you have over 900 people, I believe, killed in those three planes that went down? All because the software was shot and was not good.
Exactly.
How can have those planes still flying? That is the question. How come Boeing is not being punished for that?
I guess it's too big.
I guess it's too big to fail, right? Yeah. Yes, right.
Eventually, we're going to find somebody else. Maybe the Chinese are going to come in and take over the entire airline industry, and then we'll say what happened.
Yeah, well, the impeccable Chinese workmanship.
Well, yeah, impeccable. Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, everybody's cutting corners. I mean,
I know.
It's just...
I know.
I mean, it's sad.
It is. Well, let me get back to some of the really important issues, because you've been covering the COVID crisis seemingly every day. And it really is, I was overwhelmed by it. So evidently, it turns out, we all know that New York delivers a weekly, sometimes a twice weekly, sometimes a thrice weekly report of those being tested. And there's a positive, people being positively tested with the infections. And but there are different and disparate variants all over. And they are infecting more and more people all the time. But we seem to be no longer, I guess, afraid of it, or I don't know, or we are dismissive of the impact of the variants. And we don't wear masks, and we don't get inoculated. What's going on? Why have we become so, I don't know, obtuse about this? This is dangerous stuff. Some people have long-haul disease, and they're never going to get over it, it seems. This is not easy.
Well, that's the problem. That's the problem. We are being told that people are getting infected, yes, but they're not getting the disease as serious as the other COVID sufferers in the past. And, you know, they don't have to be hospitalized. And because we only have about 30 persons hospitalized, we're okay. Because when you diminish the spread of the disease, which is spreading, it is now not just staying even, it is infecting throughout the Mid-Hudson region at a 5% infection rate of all tested, and we're not testing enough people.
Yeah, but you know, why is there that disconnect? You report this on a daily basis, and it is really very, very pertinent because the numbers are increasing, and yet there doesn't seem to be a concern, or maybe it's an exhaustion. But I know, for example, in China, in Shanghai, they locked down the whole city. There's like about 26 million people who live there. And they all have to stay home. They can't go shopping. They can't do this. They can't do that. But even the Chinese are starting to say, we're exhausted about this. And the Chinese are starting to say, well, it's costing us too much money. Is that the issue? Is it a monetary thing? And that we all have to go to work, whether we're sick or we're not?
We're just talking about the
Titanic.
Yes,
so
that's why it
same
is.
Thing now.
Yes, I believe that the reason this is being relaxed is that the politicians and the people who run the cities need to get the people back working and spending money in the cities. They have to get the tourists back into New York, and they expect some 8,000 tourists coming to New York City. Are we testing them as they get off the plane? I don't think so.
No.
And they're going to spread it phenomenally.
Yeah.
I mean, occasionally, I guess the airlines now test them getting on board, but, you know, how good is that?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Well, we don't know.
I don't think they test you
when you
go on
board. We aren't told. We aren't told. The government is not telling us what we need to know, and it's not enforcing precautions, not even putting out precautions, and that's what they're not doing.
Well, I don't think that's a problem
in our
system. We have in our system, it's a democratic system. We're allowed to do what we want as long as we don't harm other people. But this is not something where you say, well, you're walking around with a gun and you're going to shoot somebody. So you could be infected and you're not taking care of it, or you financially can't take care of it, and you're embarrassed to even mention it, or you need the money, so you go to work, and you could be infecting more people. We don't have a mechanism to deal with this. The Chinese, they say everyone's locked down, and if we see you on the street, we'll shoot you dead. And that's what they do. And so is there a balance? Can we ever come to a balance? Because I don't see how. Because everyone's got an opinion.
Now we are in error on the side of it'll be okay.
Uh-huh.
We're not getting a lot of infections. We have lots of hospital beds. So if people need to be hospitalized, we have the beds for them. This has been downplayed by our leaders at every level for 9 months.
Yeah.
Easily.
Well, I remember
months,
only about
more.
2 months ago, you couldn't get a room. You couldn't find a nursing home to go through convalescence as you were recuperating. There wasn't enough room in the hospitals. You couldn't find a nursing home if you wanted to. So I don't know how we've resolved it, but that's the problem when you hear the CDC talking. It just doesn't seem that we're getting the proper information. Why can't we be told it might be getting better, but if we stay away from one another and stop going to parties, it might be better?
Yeah, this month is not going to be pretty from an infection standpoint because the school vacations start in Westchester County here on the eastern seaboard in New York. Today, and they will be off for a week, and perhaps people will travel to some sunny climes and go to Florida and mingle with people who, for the most part, don't wear masks and think that COVID is gone, and where the governor of Florida says, don't wear masks. It's okay.
Yeah.
And everybody believes him. We had a president.
That's what I never understood. I could never understand. It became like a political fodder why we ended up choosing to go one way or the other with regard to COVID and the infection rate. And why did it become political? How is it that we were cornered into a political perspective on that?
Well,
I don't get it.
It's partisanship.
It is partisanship.
When you wear a mask, remind people of what might happen to them. And so it makes them feel bad. So they don't like you when you wear a mask.
So if you wear a mask, does it say that you're a Republican, or does it say that you're a Democrat, or is it that you're just
exactly? If you wear a mask, people automatically assume you are a Democrat, the enemy.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
So you can't even hide your political perspective if you're wearing a mask. There's no way to mask
well,
that.
Well, there's
that's for sure.
There's political opportunity here. Political slogans should be put on the masks, and then more people might wear them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. That's an interesting perspective.
It's actually is good. You can have that idea. I'm sure you can use that. No.
Well.
But, you know, it's terrible. I have a tendency to just ad lib, but COVID is not really funny, and
no,
I apologize
not
for that.
Anymore.
But unfortunately, it is being downplayed by the leaders. I salute Eric Adams, the mayor of New York City, for reinstalling wearing masks on children below five.
Yeah,
I think that's a terrific change of heart by him. And he is to be saluted for that.
But do you think it's going to go beyond New York City? Because we pay a lot of attention to New York City, but Westchester is not doing it. I don't know what's with George Latimer. The numbers are increasing in Westchester County.
Through April 10th, yesterday, the COVID new cases from April 3rd to 10th went to 1,895, almost 2,000 people, which is much higher than COVID ever was in its first wave. And in the early December, we hit 26,000 shortly after we went to 2,000 infections. That's when we had the holidays from the 18th to the 1st in January, and that resulted in 36,000 new cases in January. And we got over that. We cut it down because of the vaccine. The vaccine stopped it cold.
So why is there an aversion? Are we just exhausted by it? Or is it because of the equivocation that we hear directives from the CDC or our doctors, or any of that stuff? Is it that we're just exhausted by it?
Well,
you know?
We now have a preening contest on the part of the medical establishment, where doctors seeking to enhance their prestige are questioning the judgment done previously regarding COVID spreading. And this is terrible of them. They should not do that, because it just encourages people not to get vaccinated. Vaccinations in Westchester, to show you the attitude towards getting vaccinations, they shut down the county center vaccination center. I think this is a huge mistake by the county. You have to have it there because it's the most centrally located place. But he didn't. He closed it. And so now we can expect to go to the former vaccination center when they start having events there, and it'll be a center for infection and not vaccination.
Well, you know, that's the thing that I find really compelling. When we look at the CDC, supposedly they have the last word, but it doesn't always seem that they do. They equivocate. There's a lot of pushback, whether it be from our congressional representatives or Senate representatives. Everyone's got an opinion and a position, and so it makes it very difficult for people, like regular people like me, to appreciate which is the best conduct. And I think that's very difficult to overcome because we don't know where to look first and who's reasonable.
Yes, liberal suggestions that come out, like, well, you should wear a mask because it protects you, are ignored because you have other people of prestige saying, well, it really doesn't help that much, or behavior is okay, and you know, you don't have to. You can just you know what the things I'm saying. There is constant pushback against what the CDC recommends, and the CDC doesn't even know. They have to stick to one message. They had to stick to one message, but they adopted the process of changing that message weekly. Weekly.
Well, that's the problem. That makes it I'm befuddled by it all, confused.
Yeah.
I'm still sticking confusion. To the my perspective because I'm concerned about getting infected or I'm not infected, so I feel that's a good thing for me. And then I figure other people might want to do the same thing, but we're not because there's so, like even here when we look at Westchester County, here we have our Westchester County Board Executive, George Latimer. He says one thing. Dr. Amler, who's supposed to be the one who's in charge from a medical perspective, she's
we
not
don't hear
taking
her.
A position. You don't hear
no,
from
we
her?
No, we don't hear from her enough. We don't hear from her enough. She is an expert. George Latimer should not be talking medical decisions. He should have Amler on every week to analyze the spread and what it means, but he doesn't.
So why don't we have that? Doesn't that seem a reasonable thing? I mean, hearing it from a doctor
believable.
Than to hear it from a politician.
Yeah, I would much rather hear it from a doctor who's been following this since COVID arrived in Westchester. And I mean, she is an intelligent person, and just as every reporter, every paper, every website, every news station should have a COVID toll every day on the evening news as to what the new infections were, but they don't. They don't.
I know.
And that's wrong.
It seems like a press release, and it just goes out, and it doesn't really get picked up.
And
it seems like such
COVID,
a hunky-dory sort of news story, right?
Yeah, Kathy Hochul in her briefings are the same every day. Like Latimer's COVID briefings are the same every day, and he only spends maybe 10 minutes on the COVID, if that, and uses the rest to ballyhoo various other accomplishments, which is very nice, but it used to be a COVID briefing. Not
that's what it used to be, exactly.
And
got to ask you about something else.
Yes.
It's not about COVID anymore, but the Bronx Bombers are returned to the plate at Yankee Stadium, to the cheers of fans. That started yesterday, I understand.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Back to the games. That's got to be very exciting. To be honest
with you,
I don't think I'd feel that comfortable going to Yankee Stadium. I'd rather watch it on TV.
Well,
maybe because it feels safer.
Few people wear masks in the stadium. Watched the entire opening day game because something drew me to the set. And, I'd finished my show, and I just sort of turned it on just to see what the crowd was like. But I got quiet, caught the first pitch, and I could not tear myself away. I watched the entire game. It went 11 innings.
Good for you.
I was yelling at my wife about stupid decisions and all that, and she couldn't stand it. It was like the way it used to be. I mean, yeah. I mean, an old love for the game was rekindled. I mean, and
yeah.
The more I watched the game, the more I realized, okay, so I don't like it about the fact that the home run ball is like the pitchers are pitching with a grenade because it explodes off the bat when they hit it. And maybe I don't like the shifts and banning the shifts, and maybe I don't like pitching changes, but I notice there are subtle adjustments. The pitchers are pitching balls that I've never seen do things now. They're cheating. They're putting, like, Mel Allen used to say, he put a little extra on that pitch. And as a kid, I thought, oh, he means that the pitcher just made an extra effort. But I think it was a double entendre that the pitcher was loading it up with tobacco juice, Vaseline. Whitey Ford used his belt buckle to scratch the ball. And pitchers are highly competitive.
Notorious.
Yes, yeah. And when they lowered the mound in 1968, because the pitchers were shedding out everybody around the league, they lowered the mound, and that really hampered the pitchers, and that brought in a return to the spitball, popularized by Gaylord Perry, among others. And so now I am seeing the pitchers really smoking the ball, and you know, 95, 99 mile an hour pitching. And you never used to see that on a regular basis.
Never.
By every pitcher. And not only that, but even though the Red Sox and the Yankees used 17 pitchers in an 11-inning game Friday, which is unheard of. I mean, you pitch your starter for three, and then you start going one inning for each guy. They can't do that throughout the season. But still,
that's amazing.
The game told me it was interesting. I saw the Red Sox outfielder make two great one-hand catches. I love great plays at snuff rallies, no matter they're done against my team or by my team.
Yeah.
Great plays you remember for all time, more than you remember any football plays.
So wait a minute. So are you suggesting to me that we're breeding people who know how to pitch? I mean,
you hit a raw nerve. The pitching profession has been suddenly dominated by mediocre pitchers who have retired, who weren't very good, didn't win 20 games in their life, did not dominate, and now they have invented the pitch count. We don't want to wear out your arms, so we're only going to allow you to pitch 60 pitches or 70, and then we're going to take you out. That is really the trouble. The pitchers don't pitch enough. Warren Spahn, who was the winningest left-handed pitcher of all time, pitched every third day, and he went all the way in his games, and he built up his arm strength, and he had spent 4 years in the Navy during World War II, and he still won 280 games. And he would have won close to 400 had he not had lost the years to the Navy. But anyway, that's what they mean. Spahn used to talk about arm strength and what was wrong with pitching today. And in the 50s, they had a pitching coach named Johnny Sane, who was a great mound mate with Warren Spahn. Spahn and Sane and pray for rain was the phrase that was invented for them. And Johnny Sane would go anywhere to any pitching staff, and he'd improve them. And the managers got jealous of that. So he only spent a little bit of time with clubs where he improved the pitching staff. But that's what you mean. You need a pitcher who knows how to pitch to teach pitching. And Seaver wasn't even booked as a pitching coach for the Mets when he retired. I mean, they don't want people to know how to do things. it's like corporate world. You got to play along to get along. Yeah.
Oh, is that really what it is? To get along? To get along? Huh.
Well,
that's amazing.
That's the way I see it. That's the way I see it. That's why you have such incompetent chief executives that have put us in such a mess today.
Well, that's
they rise to the top. It's just like how to succeed in business without really trying. The old musical was adequate. You know, Aloysius Finch, I guess his name was. But
yeah,
that pointed out how you connive your way to the top. And that was very popular because everybody going to see that absolutely knew it was true.
But I
love that baseball
born,
game.
I wasn't born on baseball, but you were. And you're even an umpire. Are you going to be going back onto the field this year? You're going to be umpiring?
No, because my legs are not strong enough. And on top of that, I don't want to wear a mask while umpiring because I wear glasses and my glasses cloud up. So I'm not going to get good vision on the hot days.
Let
alone the cold days. Yeah. Anybody who officiates with glasses and a mask is kidding you because your glasses fog up. It really limits your vision. And so I decided I would not umpire anymore. So I will miss it, but I did it for 12 years. So.
And
I'm getting less games.
You loved it.
Yeah, I'm getting less games too, maybe 20 a year. And it's not worth the aggravation that you have to take a written test and all that. And, you know, it's a good thing people don't have to take a driver's test every year, isn't it?
It is. I don't know how.
Why do you think
is,
they
but...
don't test you? Why do you think they don't test seniors over the age of 75 like I?
Probably because they're afraid to find out. They're probably afraid to get into the car with someone who's 75 and older.
Yeah, that's right. But really, they are really tough on you when you go for your driver's license. But, oh, by the way, we moved the Motor Vehicle Bureau out of the White Plains Mall, and they've moved it over to Tarrytown. But this is a real problem because – they have not opened up the new one at the over the former that Fortune House property. But this is terrible.
Uh-huh.
Nobody knew they were going to close that. It was sort of got leaked out in a press release. They didn't say when the new bureau was going to open. They didn't say what the hours were. It was another total bungle by the state on that because. You know, this is the time when kids are trying to get their learner's permits, their driver's licenses, and we've wrecked everything else for the youth of today, and now we're wrecking the thrill of driving by making the DMV their first experience with driving, an unforgettable, horrible period.
You know what really concerns me? We don't have much time now, unfortunately, but, you know, I'm starting to worry about it, especially teenagers. They want to get together. They want to commiserate. They want to go dating and stuff. It's got to be so difficult for them. You know, it's not like you're married and you know who your partner is, and it's not like, you know, it's different.
Yeah, and you don't have sex anyway,
you know.
I mean, it's not a problem.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
This is a very difficult time for younger people, or people who are not married. You know, they want to have a relationship, and it's very hard to do with COVID.
Yeah,
or
that's
impossible,
true. It's very
possibly hard
to do, and I'm surprised there hasn't been a website devoted to safe intimacy during COVID. There isn't.
Well, that's probably have to kiss through the mask is the way it is.
Kiss through the
listen,
mask.
John, unfortunately, we've got to go to move on to our next guest.
Just when we got on to something that people can really sink their teeth into.
We'll have to save it till next week when the numbers go through the roof. So we'll have
to
figure out something
not.
At
let's
that
Let's hope
point.
This is my last gasp, but I doubt it. The cases
went
up 47% in a week.
Well, listen, let me let you go. Just hang in there. All the best. Thank you very, very much.
All
goodbye.
Right. Mask up.
Okay. Well, let's see. Let's move on to Mr. Edelman. Mr. Edelman, Michael Edelman, is a lawyer, is also a national political analyst and a pundit. So good morning, Mr. Edelman. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy. Nice to hear your voice again.
I am really excited to talk to you. You came up with some really fantastic subjects to talk about today. And I guess I wasn't leaning towards the international, but in a sense, I think you've been able to glean something that's very pertinent, and that is like people like Tucker Carlson and Fox News. How come they're siding with good old Vladimir Putin in this crisis over Ukraine? What's wrong with them?
It's amazing. The Republican Party for decades was an anti-communist, anti-totalitarian, anti-Putin party. All of a sudden, Donald Trump becomes president, embraces Putin at Helsinki, refrains from any kind of criticism of Putin at all, which, of course, would lead an objective observer to conclude that the Putin's got something over him. But that aside, when you see somebody like Tucker Carlson try to portray a killer as somebody he'd like to support, it's really fantastically amazing. And the reason they're doing this has to do with white Christian nationalism. That is the basis.
Really? Does it go that far?
Yes. That's exactly what it is, yes. Because if you look at far-right groups in this country, they're worried about theory, which is supposedly where black and brown people are being brought into the country to mm-hmm. replace white voters. And they're also looking at the fact that Putin is close to the Russian Orthodox Church hierarchy.
Right.
And there are really no black and brown people in Russia at all. So this has to do with keeping America white and Christian.
And I think this is going to fly in America, but our population
is also very mixed, isn't it? Carlson has the number one watched cable news commentator on air. He is number one.
Mm.
He is higher than anybody on Fox, and he's higher than anybody on any other station. And yes,
wow.
it's flying with a huge segment of the Republican base, maybe 30%.
Wowee, that's amazing. I had no idea it was that effective, his reporting and his pontifications.
Yeah.
I've never realized it. Are we going to be able to put this back into a sense of order, or is America really so scared of people of color populating the nation?
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it already askew? Don't we have so many people who are of color?
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of color.
We're close to being a minority-majority nation where there are more people of color than there are white people, and that scares And people like Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham use that, leverage that, to increase the viewership on their shows, because for them it's all about advertising dollars and how much money they make.
Yeah.
And if they can make more money by dividing America, they'll do it. Time and again, they will do it.
Well, you know, I got to ask you then. Okay, so we have a large population. Particularly Republican-leaning people who are concerned about the changing demographic of the nation, and so they've got a position, and Tucker Carlson is espousing it. But what about the rest of the population? Isn't there a pushback to to make it more reasonable? And besides, what is the fear if someone of color gets a position of power, if they're the mayor of the city of New York or if they're governor of a particular state? What's the problem?
This goes back to slavery and Jim Crow, where after the slaves were freed, they still didn't enjoy, black people still didn't enjoy the same rights as white people in the South. They were viewed as second-class citizens. They were treated as second-class citizens, and they were treated as if slavery still existed, even though it did not. And this is something that happened. So young people in post-slavery South in the 1870s, the 80s, the 90s, et cetera, were brought up to believe that as white Southerners, they were better than blacks. Mm-hmm. And this was ingrained in the laws of Southern states, in the political candidates of Southern states, where George Wallace said segregation now, segregation forever. I mean, this was the way they thought. Now, all of a sudden, you have national legislation making it unlawful to discriminate, protecting voting rights of blacks, and now they're going nuts again. This is still ingrained in many people throughout the South and the United States.
But don't people recognize that even though there's supposedly a level playing field, many people of color don't get the same opportunity as people who may be white or people of greater means? A lot of it has to do with financial capacity. You know, not everybody can get an education because they don't have the money to pay for an education. Mm-hmm. And not every institution is free. Harvard is not free. Yale is not free. So many other big name operations where the educational capacity is so much greater than maybe even a city college, university, or a 2-year college, or community college. It's not quite the same. And the biggest thing, the difference where a lot of people don't recognize it, the way you get employed in life, the trajectory is through the school you go to. So if you go to a school with a great alumni, they're going to employ you because the first people they employ are people that are alumni to that particular institution. So if you go to Penn State, you're going to get hired by somebody who's got a business and you'd be working for some Penn State graduate, except they're 20 or 30 years your senior. And that's the difference between one institution and the other. Are we moving toward that direction, or is there just not enough institutions that can accommodate the population?
Well,
and
it's not about who. I don't think it's about who went to what college at this point with minorities in America, because many of them didn't go to any colleges. And this is about the United States trying to make progress from being basically the only nation in the modern world that had slavery. And then relegated its former slaves to second-class citizens, deprived them, by the way, of the ability to go to any other college other than black colleges like Howard. So even if you watch the hearings on television of Judge Ketanji Jackson, Ketanji Brown, you see the vitriol dripping from the mouths of some Southern senators.
I couldn't believe it. I was
John Cornyn. That's left over. That's not the kind of thing that about the Kavanaugh, by the way. That's a whole different thing. Kavanaugh had somebody step forward and said he acted inappropriately when he was younger, and they went back and forth on that. There was nothing in her background to indicate anything other than a successful education, including law review. Harvard and being a trial judge and being a court of appeals, a federal court of appeals judge.
Mm.
And so now they didn't want a black woman on the Supreme Court, and it was pretty obvious where they were coming from.
when America was trying to balance out its inequity of certain people who wanted to go to school, that was like in the 1960s in the United States, there was there was a bias then too. And then so it disheveled a lot of people who may have been white, who were marginalized for people who were not white or had some other definition that the government looked at and said, well, we don't want these people in. We want other people in to give people a chance to, I guess, to balance out the population of students that had opportunity. But we didn't have more seats at the schools. So people got dismissed because they were no longer the flavor student of the month or the year. And I don't know if that ever cleared up. How is it, like, I remember my cousin's husband, he went to Harvard, and it was shocking because he was Jewish, he's still Jewish, and he got in, but then years later it changed, and the number of Jews that went there wasn't so great, but there was a bias against Jews. How did Jews eventually get more people into the university, to a Harvard and to a Yale? How did that come about? Or is it just, I guess, you get to know people who are part of the alumni? That's how you got in?
No. No, I don't think so. I don't think the alumni have anything to do with who gets into college.
So what happened?
That's the board of the college, the admissions board. That reviews the book.
Okay.
Nothing happened except that there are other people that were either just as qualified or more qualified.
Right.
They're supposed to do it on the basis of your SAT scores. And, you know, and after that, being colorblind.
There was a limited number of seats at the colleges. And then when the correction took place, people got disheveled or pushed to the side. And we're still trying to ameliorate that concern. Are we getting closer? Are we building more universities? Are we giving more people an opportunity? Or is this just wishful thinking?
I think it's a two-step forward, one-step back situation. Well, we make progress along those lines of leveling the playing field, and then we don't do it for a time. So. You know, the Trump administration was a particular example in how not to move forward. You're even seeing in France that Marine Le Pen is now giving Macron, Emmanuel Macron, a run for his money as they vie for prime minister, president of France, in the election. So there's going to be a runoff.
Yeah, 2 weeks away.
She came in very close. A lot closer than the first time around when Macron beat her 2-1.
Well, that was a thing that was very interesting because she got very close, even though there was a third character by the name of Zemmour. I don't know if I pronounced it correctly, but he pulled out, and she's expected to pick up his votes. I think he got like 7% of the vote, and she's thinking that she might get it. It'll move over to her side of the margin. Does it look like Macron's concept of being more encompassing of the population is going to fail? She's more on the right-hand side of the political aisle.
Well, that's an understatement. She's on the far right spectrum of political ideology. She's a fascist. Her father was a fascist and a Nazi. And she's trying to look good, trying to clean up for the election. But, you know, Macron has apparently not impressed enough people with his ability to keep France in the center. I think he'll still win, but he won't win by what he won by the last time around. This is his second term that he's running for now. I don't think any French president has gotten a second term in recent memory.
I don't remember it at all, to be honest. It's amazing.
That's a trend towards neoliberalism.
Yeah. What are they struggling with? Is it that internationalization of a nation like France? Do they have the same problems that we have to some extent, an influx of new immigrants that don't speak the same language, have a different religion, have a different color,
mm-hmm.
different ethnicity?
Mm-hmm.
Is that
mm-hmm.
the problem where society needs to inculcate a larger pie, but the opportunities don't exist? So is France starting to deal with the same issues that we've been trying to deal with in the United States, except they don't have slavery there, but it was a different sort of slavery.
No, but
lack of opportunity.
France was pretty much everybody was Catholic. I mean, there weren't a lot of different ethnicities in France. The Catholic Church was, the hierarchy originally before these countries had names. And when people come in, it shakes up the social order. And there's that's why
we have so many
like
Muslims
Marine Le Pen
coming in.
There you go. So that's what Marine Le Pen and people like her are catering to. They're pandering based on these people coming in. So it's going to take quite a while to let this stuff work out.
Do you think that like a country like France, they're trying to, I guess, accommodate a new population, new religions, new ethnicities? Are they going to be able to do that? Because we're having trouble doing it here, and there seems to be a larger playing field here. We've got different issues. But we are also seeing that there's a great deal of animosity against people of the Muslim faith. I don't know where any of this is going to go. Is that whole concept of internationalizing a nation, is that working? Or do you need something a little bit closer together, like Germany? It's predominantly German, even though they also have now an influx of new immigrants coming into the country as well.
Mm-hmm.
So how does each nation continue to thrive economics? We're employing people who are getting less paid at the socioeconomic level in Germany and in France and wherever you want to look, and that's the division.
Yeah.
It's all about money.
Well, it's all about what's happening is it's dividing between those, the haves and the have-not, but not necessarily
uh-huh.
money, in terms of being perceived as an elite because you're educated.
Uh-huh.
This is a contest between people that don't have any education or very minimal education and other
mm-hmm.
people that do have a lot of education. And you see it break down when you see the voting patterns in the United States. I don't know much about the voting patterns in France, but I would bet they're very similar, that the people that live in Paris and live in other French cities who are educated
mm-hmm.
and perceived as elite are resented by the people that are not, and that are, locals and that don't go to high school. And so it's a whole thing. I didn't write a book on it, so I can't tell you. But there are plenty of books about it.
Well, I know I'm an immigrant, for example, so I never thought of telling this new nation that I came to see. I never really thought of coming to America, but it turns out my parents found relatives that survived the war. And so when we found out that they survived, they ended up already living in the United States. So we came and that's so we could bring the family together. We were all,
uh-huh.
all from different places. So, but I never thought of defining how America should be thought of, because I adopted what America thought of itself, not that I was going to impose what I thought was right, because I came from a different
mm-hmm.
place with different attitudes, different mm-hmm. language, different religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely different.
Mm-hmm.
But we're getting
problem.
A sense where people want to hold on to the tradition that they were born with. Is that a new dynamic? You'd expect if you're German.
Historically,
you're
American.
German.
Well, historically in America, people came here and they became Americans, and they shed
right.
whatever traditions they had from the countries they came, and they all became one. You know,
but that
they
was
all
what,
became 50s, Americans.
60s, 70s. When did it change?
That's a good
Why
question. I don't. Well, it changed. It changed gradually. And
yes, it did.
Unfortunately, there are, you know, you have people that stay with their own kind, as it were, and because they're comfortable and they don't want to adopt the traditions and the language of the new country, and that really should change.
Well, because if one doesn't change and one doesn't adopt the nation in which they live, which they
uh-huh.
chose to go to,
yep.
or whatever rationale that brought them here, you would think that if they don't inculcate some of the concepts, not everything, you don't have to change your religion, you don't have to change your ethnicity, you don't have to change your gender or anything else,
mm-hmm.
can't that work if you become more Americanized so that you can have a sense and also fit into the process?
Of course.
So why aren't people doing that? We seem to be at each other's throats.
Well, most people that come to this country become American. If they don't do it in the generation that comes here, it happens in the next generation.
You're right. I didn't think of that. You're right.
So, you know, I mean, there are plenty of people here from all different places that you wouldn't know by their speech pattern where they were from, because they all speak
Correct.
American. They speak English.
Correct.
American English.
Mm-hmm. American
English.
Right.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So there's a lot to tackle, but it seems these are new. Does this happen every generation where there's a new issue to be concerned about? You know, like, okay, so, you know, I'm here like about 23 years now. So
mm-hmm.
it's only like
mm-hmm.
one generation for me. So I've only seen like
right.
one generation. So I don't know what it's like if it was two generations back. I don't know if I'll live two generations long in America. You know, it's just a question of time. I'm not
well,
a
no,
young
I
guy.
I don't think this was not a problem in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Uh-huh.
We were all united against the Soviet Union and the Red Menace.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And minorities were not about to gain a majority back then. So people
right.
who felt uncomfortable now probably didn't feel uncomfortable then. We didn't have the division that we have now. We didn't have people that were preaching to the hard right wing of the Republican
mm-hmm.
Party, like the Tucker Carlsons and the Rush Limbaughs before he died. These people have made it a cottage industry of fear.
Yeah.
Of engaging in fear tactics. That's what they're doing. They're making people afraid that the border is being overwhelmed, you know, that the hordes are coming to take the United States, that there's a great replacement theory where Democrats are trying to have people come as immigrants so they can increase the voting numbers. So this was not an issue in the 1980s and even in the 1990s. It's only become an issue recently. I believe that it's become an issue as Fox News has gained more and more viewers, that they've preached this kind of division. And, you know, and you see what we
mm-hmm.
have as the result.
Well, that's the question. I had heard years ago, not like 20 years ago, but like maybe 5 years ago, I had heard that we were hiring more people to watch the borders. So whoever would want to come across the Mexican-American border, there were a lot of people that were employed to do that work, and they were the border guards. Don't they pick up most people who are crossing the border or attempting to cross the border illegally, or are we permitting people to cross the border? because it just doesn't make sense. We have so many people employed to do that work. You don't need a fence necessarily.
Yeah, but the border, we have a lot of people, but we don't have 3,000 miles worth of people.
Uh-huh. So the whole concept is that they are coming across the border.
Yeah, sure they are.
You've got mail.
Mm-hmm.
The border is porous still. The answer is not putting up a wall. I'm not sure what the answer is, but the problem is emanating from the chaos that exists in Honduras, in Nicaragua, and El Salvador.
Yeah.
So until that
issue
is solved,
also coming across from Asia. You know, people are coming in from Pakistan and Afghanistan, and they cross over Africa, and then they get to South America, and then they come across the Mexican border.
Okay.
They're not Mexicans. They are literally all over the world. And
you could see
the differences by their facial features.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Well, that's the problem, and that's what politicians are using to promote their constituents, people like Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
That's their ticket. They think that's their ticket to the presidency. So that's what they do.
Truly amazing. What about the president, El Presidente? You know, he doesn't seem to be doing very well. I was surprised, though, he was able to keep his golf course in the Bronx of all places. But he's losing on every other front. Is he going to be put away, in prison? It looks like we're getting closer and closer.
I'm not sure that the Justice Department. I think the way to go here is to put everybody that was around him under indictment and leave him alone. Because if you indict him, he might make him stronger. By his face when he screams witch hunt, but if you indict Ivanka and Don Jr. and Peter Navarro and other people that were in the White House, then it's going to be perfectly obvious that he was planning the insurrection, directing it, and hoping that it succeeded without having to charge him criminally. But we're going to have to wait and see because.
Yeah.
It's the Justice Department that will make that decision.
He's getting back into politics again. Does he have much of a voice, or is he being challenged by other Republicans who are looking to climb to the top?
No, he's not being directly challenged because they know. They don't want to pay the price of him calling them names like Little Marco.
Right.
Okay. So they're not declaring, positioning themselves like DeSantis is positioning himself to run. But it's all up to Trump. If Trump runs, they're out. Nobody's going to primary Trump unless it's a moderate Republican like Liz Cheney or Adam Kinzinger that wants to primary him and stay on the ballot in swing states as independents so that they can drain Republican votes and prevent him from ever holding public office again.
Mm-hmm. And his effort to get back into politics, is that going to sway, or is it going to give Biden an opportunity to find a successor?
Biden's not running again. He's going to be 82.
No, I know he's not, and I don't know if Kamala Harris has got the juice to become a presidential candidate.
Well, it doesn't make a difference. There'll be a Democratic primary, whether Kamala Harris is interested or not. It's not going to automatically go to Kamala Harris.
Mm. Wow, it's going to be very, very interesting. What about, what's the guy? Oh, yeah, Buttigieg. Is it conceivable? He's a brilliant guy. But is it conceivable that someone who's gay could become presidential candidate in America?
Not yet.
Or is it still biased?
Yeah, there's still plenty of bias. So not yet. Mm. The answer is
not yet.
He could not yet.
Yeah, he just seems he's got it all. So it's just amazing. Well, unfortunately, we're at the 11 o'clock hour that went too quickly. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Michael Edelman. What an honor. Thank you for making the time. I'll speak to you next week.
Yep.
Be well. Thank you. My regards at home. Okay, let's move on. Bear with me a second as I move on to the next screen, assuming I could find it. Okay, here we are. Oh, and look at this. We've already got Mr. Matten on the line. Good morning, Ron Matten. How are you? He's a Yonkers politician, in case someone didn't know. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning, Ezzy. How are you?
I'm very excited to speak to you today because, well, I'm always excited to speak to you. How are you doing? I'm just still enamored that you're spending so much time trimming down. Are you trimming down for an elected office, or you're just
doing it because you just want to get into your pants? I turned 60 this year, so
good for you.
Make sure that there's a good number of years ahead of that 60 number. So I just try to. It's very easy to get heavier and as you get older. I got heavier too,
but then I've lost a tremendous amount of weight, and I've been doing it diligently. So I'm in shock. I'm in better shape now than when I was in my teens, which is a real shocker to me.
Good.
So you wish you could
relive those parts of your life and maybe not do some things like smoking or something else.
I did that too.
Me as well. I smoked not in my teens. I started a little later. I started
in my early 20s. What was wrong with me? Mentally, there was something wrong. I had no idea. There might still be something mentally wrong with me, but I'm not so sure. You never can tell.
I had a friend of mine who lived in Israel who smoked like a chimney. And I said to him, why?
That's for sure.
I said, why do you smoke so much? He goes, you try living in a country where you're surrounded with people who want to kill you.
Mm.
I guess there's a lot of...
That sounds a little bit too pathological for me. You know, I was there too, and I didn't start smoking because of that.
I guess at one point...
We all have a different sense.
It was very much a social activity, smoking.
Absolutely.
You borrow a cigarette, you lend somebody a cigarette, you light somebody a mm-hmm. cigarette. It is an interactive activity. And then when the smokers became pariahs and you had to go outside, then there was mm-hmm. no reason to go outside with somebody, have a cigarette and have a conversation. I started smoking actually in boot camp because you got 15 minutes for a cigarette. At various mm-hmm. parts of the day, so it became this social activity. And then on the ship, when you sit, you're on watch, you're hanging out, you're talking, you light up a cigarette, or you go out on the deck, and you watch the aircraft carrier, do flight ops, the planes take on a cup of coffee and a cigarette. You know, on the water is very relaxing. So you put all those things together. And you don't realize how much damage you do over the years.
That's very true. Well, let's talk about damage on a political scheme of things. I was wondering, do you think that we've come to a different place from a political perspective? And Yonkers is, I always think of Yonkers as a little bit of rock and roll, a little bit of country. So we have a little bit of each of those stripes within us. Some people will cling to one party or the other. Are we getting more engaged in our politics, or is there something else that drives us? Is it our ethnicity or our sexual orientation or our gender or anything else that differentiates us from one dogma or the other?
But Yonkers, how do we define ourselves? Yonkers is a very different place. It's not less political, but less I'm going to say, less bifurcated than the nation, I think. So while it is political, it doesn't set up so much as left versus right or Democrats versus Republicans. I think there's kind of a fight in Yonkers, and it has to do with Yonkers' history. If you go back to the Judge Sands ruling, the NAACP lawsuit against the city,
yes,
in terms of zoning and schools and everything else along those lines. Because of Yonkers' history in that, I think there's a more heightened sensitivity to that, and it doesn't so much break down along political lines. You know, Mike Spano got himself in a little bit of hot water a few weeks ago when he made an offhanded comment on a radio show regarding Jamal Bowman, and he should be arrested for his vote. That was taken very differently in communities of color than it was elsewhere in Yonkers. That was Democrat to Democrat, and that was felt as though an attack on Mr. Bowman, a very liberal, he claims to be the fifth member of the squad. Now, I'd love to be the fifth member of the Beatles, but I'm not sure I'd want to be the fifth member of the squad. That's just a personal observation, though.
I tend to agree with you. I don't think that the squad, whether they're three or four or five, have been that effective. And I don't know how lucid there is.
I don't think they don't follow Yonkers. You know, the ideology doesn't follow Yonkers politics as a whole.
No, it doesn't.
You know, it might follow some Upper Manhattan or South Bronx ideology, but it doesn't. You know, Yonkers is still, even though it's largely Democrat. I mean, I saw the map of the 90th AD. It's a color coded map, and dark blue, to light red. No dark reds in there, and a lot of purple. A lot of purple throughout the city. So while the city is still largely Democratic in terms of registration, I don't think it's largely Democratic in terms of ideology.
Well,
so
one thing that, that's question. One thing, to bring back to what you said, based on what the mayor had said, and is there a failure of really communicating? Because I don't know if the mayor said what he said in a derogatory or in a biased way. I think he was really speaking about the demeanor of the city, But I don't understand why he never responded and gave a retort to define if it was maligned before or it was taken as a malignment of Mr. Bowman. Okay, fine. So that's the way it may have been taken, but that is not the way I think it was presented.
I don't think that was meant what was meant by it. I think here you have a city that largely depends upon federal and state aid. Of our $1.2 billion budget, only about $400,000 is on property taxes. There's another percentage on sales tax and other transfer taxes. But a large part of our money comes from state and federal aid. So we depend on that. And that's not to say we don't deserve it, because we all pay state and federal tax. So we're trying to get some of that money back to run Yonkers. I mean, the potholes, even the potholes on state road, Central Park Avenue is not a city road. We'll plow it. We'll do some pothole repair. But really, the capital money that's needed to fix that is dependent upon the state and our state delegation to do that. So when you complain about
we haven't gotten our fair share from the state for decades.
No.
Look at our schools. We haven't had a new school in over 20 some odd years.
Yeah,
and
you look at
schools
Buffalo,
are over 100 years old.
You look at Buffalo, you look at Rochester, you know, and they're receiving about 95% from the state to build a school. Yonkers receives
right.
about 36%. Now, under this new bill that, you know, that Shelley Mayer is not really that new anymore. I think it was proposed in 2016. It's really the first school we're building with it. But new for us, you know, we're getting about 72% reimbursement of eligible costs. And that's still, we have $2 billion with a B, dollars of needs within our school facilities.
Yeah, but
and
you know, with all
were,
due respect to what you said, I'm sorry, I'm very disappointed in Shelley Mayer. I don't think she's delivered. I hear a lot of talk.
Well, I don't see her delivering.
And it had nothing to do with her anyway.
No, it's not. I mean, she wrote the law. She wrote the law. She was the sponsor of the law. That's the only reason I'm bringing
her
name here. But
good,
you know,
why we couldn't get
80%, 90%, or something more. You know, they base it because we're in West.
Well, that's the point.
We're in a high
point.
Area,
is we're not getting an equal return or a reduction. As let's say Buffalo or Syracuse or Rochester, we've been hearing this hackneyed discussion, and we're still going nowhere. And I'm sorry, but the senator is not doing her job, and neither is the majority leader. What's her name? Andrea Stewart-Cousins. I'm sorry. How long does it take?
And even with the money, getting that back, it's still that $2 billion translates into a $600 million outlay for Yonkers.
Right.
And we don't have $600 million that we can pour into the school, so we do need more.
But the question still boils down to the same thing. Why is it that we don't hear this on a constant basis? And why do we have people like the Shelley Mayers of the world who don't deliver, and what is wrong with the people that we're sending up into elected office if they can't do what they're told to do, which is they're supposed to speak up for Yonkers. I don't get
it. These things only come up at budget time, and they only come up at budget time when we seem to have a shortfall. Well, everybody's flush with cash. You know, they just passed the state budget, and they have so much money, they increased tax revenue they didn't expect, as well as COVID funds, that they can't spend it fast enough. So there should have been a way of appropriating more money for school infrastructure. You're absolutely right that, particularly with the record funds that they have. But because we're not going to
get
a tax
increase. The way I understand it from my inside sources, they advised me that we are going to get the contractual agreement so that MGM Casino is going to be authorized.
That they will be granted a license, and that's great for us because we're going to get that will bring more jobs. Some people may have demons that they have to work out, but you know, whether they work their demons out at MGM Casino or whether they go to the phone
they can work out their demons for New Jersey, even if they live in Yonkers.
Right, right. I mean, look, I used to go with my, when I was in my much younger days, on a Friday night after work, I would, you know, pile in the car with a few of my friends and we'd drive down to Atlantic City, three or four times a year, not excessive, three or four times a year,
right.
You know, stay up till 3 a.m. gambling and drive home. The most I think I ever lost was $80 because that's my risk tolerance.
Oh, you're good. Very good.
My grandfather used to regularly take the bus. Remember, they used to have those buses that take down to Atlantic City. So you pay your $40. You get your $20 in quarters and your meal voucher. So he would put all his quarters in one pocket. He was actually pretty good with this. He put all the quarters in one pocket. When that pocket was empty, he put the winnings in the other pocket. When the pocket was empty with the quarters, he wouldn't dip into the winnings if he had any, and that would be it. That was the end of his day. So he was very disciplined
smart guy.
That way. Yeah, he was very disciplined that way. So I got a little bit of that, but I'll dip into the winnings if I'm doing okay. But again, I don't have a high risk tolerance. I work too hard for my money to gamble.
Right.
So exactly. I don't. It's too important. But anyway, so yeah, you're right. We're gonna get some licenses, a license down here at MGM. So that's going to bring some revenue, hopefully, into Yonkers. We do. People will maybe go out to dinner. I know they have food and everything there, so it won't be as much a boon for the surrounding businesses as one would think. The Lions Gate is really great for the surrounding businesses because those people are going to go out, they're going to eat, they're going to go out after work, they're going to grab an extra drink.
We do need to build. We don't have the facilities, unfortunately. To accommodate, we don't have the restaurants that we need because we've been deficient with that. I think we got one, Peter Kelly's operation on the waterfront. That's very nice, but we've got Zupa's and maybe a few other very small little places. We really need to build up because we don't have the restaurants.
It's interesting you say that. I have a friend of mine, Andy, who lives in Nyack. I worked with him at CUNY. He said, "Hey, I'm coming to Yonkers to meet some friends. Where's a good place to eat?"
Right. Where?
But besides XO, we've been there before. And
right.
I kind of drew a little bit of a blank. I had to talk about a few places further up, like Harvest or Half Moon.
Mm-hmm.
Half
Moon's very nice.
I'm not a restaurant connoisseur. My wife and I don't go out a lot. We tend to just go out on anniversaries, birthdays, and special occasions. That's just us. So I didn't have a lot of recommendations. That would probably be a good column for your Tribune is to do a little, if you can find somebody to do some food recommendations, some restaurant,
that's
local restaurant.
That's a brilliant idea. That's really a brilliant idea because we really don't have many. You got Peter Kelly's place. That's fine.
Yeah,
but
I'm not familiar with what's open lately. I mean, and I'm not talking about a Yonkers brewery.
Well, you got Zupa. You got a Cuban restaurant. Also, you got there's a Pakistani Indian.
I know a lot of people go to Gianna's, but I don't think it's kind of in an office.
Oh yeah,
park.
I've heard
it's
of
not.
Gianna's. Yes.
Yeah, and a lot of people have talked highly about that. But it's in an office park. I don't know if I don't know what's up at the Boyce Thompson Center. I should go take a look there. I know they've got they got a Starbucks and some other things I've seen from the street, but that opened up a few years ago and may have something in there.
It's not that there isn't a compendium of different priced and different cuisines that are available in the city, so that it's hard to find that complexity and that capacity to find something of a particular cuisine that you may want to discover or stuff like that. We just don't have that sophistication. It's a very simple, restaurant row. And we don't really have a restaurant row. And I think we really need to focus on that because we've got the population and I think people would want to come. And because we aren't focusing on it and I don't understand why. I really don't get it.
Yeah, no, particularly, again, with gambling opening up and some of the other things coming. Yeah, I could see that. By the way, I did hear that, some things are happening, and I don't know the details, so maybe you do. So I'm gonna be the inquisitor now. Something was happening with the plant, and some interest in losing JFK Marina. Did you hear anything about that?
Oh, there is talk about something with JFK Marina. evidently Harka is somehow involved in it. There's something going on, but I tried to reach out to somebody that was involved in it, and I left two messages. They never called back, and
yeah,
so I don't know where that thing is going.
That would be a terrible
loss. I have no
idea. It would be a terrible loss to Yonkers. It would be a terrible loss. From what I read, they're only looking at taking the grassed area by the pavilion. But from what I read, that would be a terrible loss to Yonkers if we were to
The problem is that I got a notice about it, and what was written was so poorly written, totally unexplained, and then I called up to get more information about it. I left two messages. They never called back ever, and then I just gave up because this is a joke. It's constant. This should be a political issue, political concern for the entire city. But instead, it's being kept under wraps by some bozos that think they're doing something because they want to be in charge, but they're not in charge of anything because it's going nowhere. It's already gotten to the point where it is failing. And if we lose that, it's wrong. Wrong.
Agreed.
Because the law, and this is the thing, this was just so stupid. The law forbids any of this thing to happen. It would be illegal because the law stipulates that that property needs to be the way it is now, not any other way. And it's in perpetuity. But no, we don't have a discussion. That's typical Yonkers. That's the reason we're a failure. Because we don't get the facts, and you got people who just want to stick their hand into something and control when in reality they don't have the capacity to control, they don't have the support in order to be able to be in control, and at the end, the very people that they claim they want to protect are not being protected because they are in the way. This is such a game. I'm getting tired of it.
I'm in full agreement. It's a loss for all of Yonkers if we start taking our parkland, particularly this piece, because you're right. I think there's a state deed that requires it be used in a certain way.
Correct.
As parkland. But if we start subverting those things, I don't care if you decide to give us another couple of acres somewhere else. It's not the same. So I'm in agreement.
The same because it's an area that was promised, and you can't compensate it by some other property. Where are you going to put the property on Buena Vista Avenue? Really, it's not the same. It's like an environment, that's in the north part of the city. There are buildings that are going up around there as well. So, this is part of the view. We have a view of the Hudson River and a view of the Palisades. Why would anybody want to take that away, especially when the law says you're not permitted to do it?
Agreed.
How do they think they're going to get away with this? But it's Yonkers, so maybe they will. They'll be able to corrupt the law.
I'm unfortunately dealing with a small work emergency, so I have to jump off a few minutes early, if that's all right.
I got you. No problem.
All right. Thanks.
No
I appreciate it. We'll speak.
Be well.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the time. All right.
Be
bye-bye.
Well. Take care. Bye. Well, there we have it. Unfortunately, he had to run early today, Ron Matten, but he's a Yonkers politician, very, very clued in. He ran for Yonkers City Council president, just didn't get enough support, even though he had the qualifications and the work attitude, and just didn't quite make it. And So I'm hoping he's got such a compendium of knowledge that is just brilliant. And so I hope that he seeks political office for into the future. That would really be very, very good. All right, let's quickly look and see what else is happening here. Bear with me a moment as I try to capture this. I want to go over. I just hope that I don't get a delivery. Sometimes that comes in on Mondays. You know, around this time, it always drives me crazy, but there's nothing I could do about the changes and the time schedules. They just show up when they show up. So bear with me a moment as I look to find, oh, yeah, this is what I wanted. Hold on a minute. Okay. Want to see if I can cover with you some things with regard to what's going on the world stage. And okay. Now let's quickly look and see. This is very interesting with regard to news. With regard to Ukraine, a pro-Russia demonstrations, the pro-Russia demonstration that's sparking outrage in Germany. Seems many view the demonstration, some in the form of vehicle convoys, as support for Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. But organizers say their goal is to highlight discrimination against Russians in Germany. Pro-Russia protesters rallied for a second day in Germany on Sunday, demanding an end to discrimination against the country's large Russian-speaking population since the conflict in Ukraine erupted. So around 600 people marched in the financial hub in Frankfurt, with many waving Russian flags. A similar-sized demonstration took place in the northern city of Hanover, police had said, accompanied by a convoy of 350 cars. However, the start was delayed because authorities ruled that the vehicles, I don't know what they call that thing. It's the vehicles could not be covered by flags. So I guess on the front of the car, you couldn't put something on the car which had flags on it. So anyway, organizers said that they wanted to put a spotlight on the growing intolerance toward Russians living in Germany. However, many observers have questioned whether the protests are not thinly disguised shows of support for the war. And both rallies were met by counter-demonstrations in support of Ukraine. Well, Germany has a large Russian diaspora. A day earlier, pro-Russia convoys rolled through multiple German cities. One convoy with about 190 cars drove through the southwestern city of Stuttgart with the motto, "Against discrimination against Russian-speaking people," quote unquote. Pence waved banners reading, "Stop Russophobia," quote unquote, and urged an end to discrimination against Russian-speaking children in schools. City officials had warned participants beforehand that the event could not show support for the conflict, including the display of the letters V and Z, which had become associated with the Russian invasion. Well, the pro-Russian demonstrations have sparked a backlash, with many seeing them as a show of support for the Kremlin. So bear with me a moment, because evidently that call did come in, and I've got to respond to that. So, unfortunately, so bear with me a moment, and we'll get that done. And, okay, bear with me a second, because I've got to respond to that. Sometimes I wonder how I get this done, but that's what happens when I'm on medical, I have to do medical deliveries, and so that's how it works. So sorry about that. Anyway, you should be able to, it's only about 11:29, so we'll be able to cover the rest of the international news in about two or three more minutes. So bear with me a second, because the delivery is just about here. Bear with me a moment. Thank you very much. What a pleasure. Thank you. No, this one? Perfect. Okay, thank you. Stay well. Bye. Okay, so bear with me a moment. Able to get this done. All right, let's just get this over with. And we'll be all right. So bear with me a minute. I'm almost there. Okay. All right. I think this is not as bad as I thought today. Okay. So let's move on to what else is happening here. So the pro-Russian demonstration has sparked a backlash, with many seeing them as a show of support for the Kremlin. So a similar convoy in Berlin triggered sharp criticism last weekend. Germany's newspaper called The Bild, B-I-L-D, called it a parade of shame. As the demonstration, billed as apolitical, was held on the same day that revelations of the alleged Russian atrocities in the Ukrainian city of Bucha came to light. So for heaven's sake, how could you allow this convoy of shame in the middle of Berlin? The Ukrainian ambassador to Germany, Andriy Melnyk, asked Berlin Mayor Franziska Giffey. Giffey replied that she understood his anger, but could not penalize people for merely waving Russian flags. Since Russia began its invasion of Ukraine in February, German authorities have registered 383 anti-Russian and 181 anti-Ukrainian crimes. Germany is home to around 1.2 million Russians and 325,000 Ukrainians, plus more than 316,000 who have arrived as refugees since the start of the conflict. So what's going on? Now, this is very interesting. German-Russian relations through history took place because both Russia and Ukraine traced their cultural ancestry to the Kievan Rus period in the early Middle Ages, when a Rus federation of Slavic, Baltic, and Finnic, meaning the Finnish peoples, formed a common identity. Missionaries from the Germanic peoples were eventually replaced by diplomats, and there's a picture depicting the baptism of Prince Vladimir of Vladimir. Vladimir is Russian, Vladimir is Ukrainian, in 1987, which hangs in Kiev Cathedral. So there are things like that that bring all this stuff together. And here's something that's written in German. Wir sind gegen die Diskriminierung der russischen Sprachen Menschen. So it says, we are against the discrimination against Russian-speaking people. And that's part of the demonstration. So you get stuff like this, which is like overwhelming, but very, very interesting. And the more we know, the better off we are. So let me just quickly look. 1 second. And move on to some other things that will matter. Now, let's look at something else that's happening. We were talking with Michael Edelman earlier, and with regard to Marine Le Pen and President Emmanuel Macron, France is facing an attack on its democracy, is really what it's boiling down to, and they will both enter into a runoff election. French voters will need to ask themselves if they want to preserve their democracy, and that's the question. Though this might seem like a rerun of the 2017 second round of voting, the situation is not quite the same. 5 years ago, as international observers were fearing a Le Pen victory, the country's own political analysts categorically and unanimously excluded that outcome. This time around, however, French pundits with an air of resignation say that the far-right Le Pen could win. French polls show her neck and neck with Macron in round two. How did this happen? Especially as polls had predicted Macron would win comfortably. His ratings went up even further after Russia invaded Ukraine as the French rallied around their leader in times of crisis. But that effect waned quickly. As the West imposed sanctions on Russia, prices at home increased further, and with it the main worry, how to make ends meet. Le Pen seemingly addressed that concern. She had roamed small villages, towns, and markets for months, playing the part candidate close to the people, telling everybody that once elected, she'd hold prices steady for essential goods and lower value-added tax or VAT on fuel and energy commodities. The question is Le Pen in touch with the electorate? Macron waited until the very last moment to enter the campaign. He seemed preoccupied dealing with Russian President Vladimir Putin. His campaign amounted to a few small gatherings with one larger meeting, and voters got the impression that their president didn't care about their day-to-day lives and was just a bit too certain of his victory. What's more, someone else inadvertently helped Le Pen gain ground, the far-right political journalist turned candidate Eric Zemmour. Campaigning with blatantly racist slogans, he seemed even more extreme than Le Pen. That bumped him up in the polls for a while, even above Le Pen. But then his ratings took a plunge last, not least as he hesitated to support taking in Ukrainian refugees and maintained an ambiguous attitude towards Putin, for whom he had expressed admiration in the past. So bizarrely, her campaign didn't take a dent despite her historic proximity with Putin and the financial backing she had received in the past from Russia. If anything, she gained ground. Zemmour's crass remarks slowly but surely established her as a soft far-right candidate. Make no mistake, the 53-year-old's platform is still very much rooted in the spirit of the party's co-founder, her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, convicted multiple times for downplaying the Holocaust and inciting racial hatred. As president, Le Pen would hold a referendum to enshrine a so-called principle of national preference in France's constitution. So people with French nationality would then have precedence over foreigners when it comes to access to jobs, housing, or health care. Discrimination would be legalized. And as president, she would make it punishable by law to help migrants enter and remain in France without authorization. She would limit the right to asylum and not hesitate to send foreigners back to countries where they face prosecution or persecution or death. Although she doesn't directly mention a Frexit, a French exit, in her program anymore, these reforms would be practiced, would lead to one and fit in with her anti-globalization vision and the plan to control French borders and reinforce economic protectionism. While all that is in stark contrast to Macron's pro-European Union, pro-integration position, he's far from flawless. The French criticize him for his market-oriented reforms, favoring entrepreneurs, earning him the moniker, the president of the rich, quote unquote. He has said he'd go even further if reelected by increasing the retirement age and forcing people on welfare to work or participate in job training. Meanwhile, environmental groups have slammed Macron for failing to tackle climate change. Women's rights groups have accused him of not doing enough for gender equality. But under Macron, unemployment has gone down and the economy is doing relatively well, also due to the billions of euros that the government has spent to soften the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. And although he promises to limit immigration, he wants to introduce new laws to prohibit discriminating against foreigners when it comes to jobs or housing. So most of all, the criticism against Macron does not compare to the threat a Le Pen victory would mean for the very foundations of French democracy. The only way to protect the country against totalitarianism is to stop her from getting to power, is what the thinking goes, and French voters should ask themselves how dearly they cherish their democracy before making their choice in 2 weeks. So this is going to be very, very compelling, to say the least. Now, this is very, very interesting when it comes to wounded Russian soldiers. Evidently, they're filling hospitals in Belarus. Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, dead and wounded Russian soldiers have been arriving in Belarus. Most officials and doctors refuse to talk openly about the specific numbers, and details remain sketchy. Well, since Russian forces invaded Ukraine on February 24, the Russian Defense Ministry has reported its military losses just once. As of March 2nd, it said 498 soldiers had been killed and 1,597 had been wounded. Ukrainian officials, on the other hand, have said that there were at least 14,200 dead on the Russian side. Probably neither side is telling the truth. So according to Belarusian media reports and Telegram channels, many wounded Russian soldiers are being brought to Belarus to receive medical care before being transported to Russia. Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko confirmed as much, saying that after 5 days of war, between 160 and 170 Russian soldiers had received treatment in the cities of Gomel, Mazir, and another Belarusian town. So that's the story. So we'll have to see what goes on, because you never exactly know exactly where things are. It's always a real problem. Bear with me a second here. Now, let me just quickly look and see some other things here. Oh, just in case you didn't know, Pakistan's new prime minister is Shahbaz Sharif. Shahbaz Sharif is the younger brother of Nawaz Sharif, who was prime minister 3 times before. Shahbaz Sharif's victory was secured when members of the opposition party of ousted Prime Minister Imran Khan resigned. So that's what's going on there. One second now. One second here. Now, let's just look at what's going on here. Ukraine's economy has plunged because of the Russian invasion. So the World Bank said that Ukrainian economy is expected to contract by nearly half as Russia's assault has shut down businesses and slashed exports. The European Union's Joseph Borrell accuses Russia of provoking hunger. It seems that Russian forces are causing scarcity by bombing Ukraine. A country known for its massive agricultural sector, said the European Union's top diplomat, Joseph Borrell. They are bombing Ukrainian cities and provoking hunger in the world, said the European Union's official from Luxembourg, where foreign ministers of all 27 European Union countries were meeting to discuss further steps against Russia. Well, the war in Ukraine has prompted concerns of wide-reaching food crisis, and many fear that a failed harvest in Ukraine would be especially tough on Africa, where the European country serves a major supplier of wheat and sunflower oil. Borrell also said that the European Union would continue discussions on sanctioning Russia's oil and gas exports, although, quote, no decision has been made today on those issues. Now, a German company is ready to supply used tanks to Ukraine. German arms manufacturer Rheinmetall is ready to prepare up to 50 used tanks, battle tanks. They're called Leopard 1 for possible delivery to Ukraine. The first Leopard 1 could be delivered in 6 weeks. Armin Papperger, the head of Rheinmetall, told the Handelsblatt newspaper. However, the company still needs a green light from the German government. According to Handelsblatt, the paper, politicians from Germany's coalition government made up of Social Democrats, the Greens, and Free Democrats are open to a possible delivery of the Leopard 1 tanks. Following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Germany has reversed a longstanding policy of not sending weapons to conflict zones and supplied Kyiv with anti-tank weapons and missiles. However, in an interview with Augsburger Allgemeine Zeitung, the newspaper, published on Saturday 9. Germany Defense Minister Christine Lambrecht had said that she sees hardly any possibilities left to supply Ukraine with weapons and equipment directly from the German military stockpiles. Leopard 1 tanks are already quite old. The Bundeswehr has long been using the successor model, the Leopard 2, the first version of which was introduced as far back as 1973. Austrian Chancellor Karl Nehammer said his hour-long talk with Russia's President Vladimir Putin in Moscow was, quote, not a friendly meeting, end quote. Nehammer described the conversation as, quote, very direct, open, and tough, end quote, in a statement issued by his own aides. The Austrian chancellor is the first European Union leader to visit Moscow since Russia launched the invasion on February 24th. He has visited Kyiv earlier this week. Although Nehammer's visit to Moscow has raised eyebrows in the West, the conservative chancellor said he felt a duty to leave no stone unturned in his effort to end the conflict or at least alleviate the suffering of civilians. During his talk with Putin, Nehammer raised the issues of war crimes reported in Bucha and other parts of Ukraine, saying that all those responsible must be brought to justice. The Austrian leader also urged an end to the war, saying that, quote, in a war, there are only losers on both sides. So Zelensky said that if Ukraine was willing to give up territory, there would be no war. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he would definitely, quote unquote, not recognize Crimea as Russian territory in the peace talks with Moscow. Had we been willing to give up our territory, there would have been no war, Zelensky told U.S. broadcaster CBS in a 60-minute interview. At the same time, the Ukrainian leader seemed to hint that events might unfold contrary to this principle. So we need to stand firm for as long as we can, he said, according to the translation provided by CBS. But this is life. Different things happen. Top diplomats from all 27 European Union countries were meeting in Luxembourg to consider a new wave of sanctions directed against Russia. While the bloc is striving to present a united front, some reports have indicated a growing rift between the member states on further measures against Moscow. While some countries like Ireland were pushing for sanctioning Russia's massive energy imports, others were finding this approach, quote, very difficult, end quote, said Irish Foreign Minister Simon Coveney. Quote, in our view, we need to cut off that financing of war, even though it creates huge challenges and problems, Coveney had said. European Union representatives were also discussing a proposal by the European Union's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, to earmark another $544 million for the delivery of weapons and other military equipment to Ukraine. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock also called for weapons shipments in Luxembourg, saying that Ukraine needs, quote, above all, heavy weaponry, end quote, to counter Russia's attack. Croatia has become the latest European Union member to expel Russian diplomats. Foreign Ministry of Croatia said that the Russian ambassador was summoned in a protest over the brutal aggression on Ukraine and numerous crimes committed there. 18 Russian diplomats and 6 administrative staff have to leave Croatia. Several European Union countries have expelled dozens of Russian diplomats following the atrocities in Bucha and in other Ukrainian towns. The Kremlin has slammed the expulsions as a short-sighted move, quote-unquote, and warned of retaliatory steps. Well, Prime Minister of Lithuania visited Borodyanka near Kyiv. The Prime Minister of Lithuania, Ingrida Simonyte, started her visit to Ukraine in Borodyanka. This small town near Kyiv was almost completely destroyed during the Russian occupation. No words could possibly describe what I saw and I felt here, Simonyte wrote on Twitter. Ukrainian Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal, who visited the town together with his Lithuanian counterpart, has called Borodyanka, quote, one of the painful wounds on the body of Ukraine, end quote. In his post on Facebook, Shmyhal probably, I think that's Ukrainian way of saying Samuel. So I think that's right. So his name is Shmuel, vowed to bring to justice everyone who is guilty of the atrocities. Quote, Lithuania, our European partners support us on the path to justice, he added. Russia has almost finished preparations for assault on the east. The attack will begin soon. Ukrainian Defense Ministry spokesman Oleksandr Motuzhyank said in a briefing, quote, we cannot predict exactly when this will happen. These are sources from Western intelligence, he said. The Ukrainian army is ready. Well, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has previously pleaded for more weapons and aid from Kyiv's allies abroad to resist the attack. Russian forces are believed to be regrouping for a new offensive in the eastern Donbas region, the home of the two so-called People's Republics, quote-unquote, ruled by pro-Russian rebels. Austria's Neymar is going to meet Putin. Well, we told you about that meeting. And let me just see. Oh, yeah, Ukraine says that 166 cultural sites have been destroyed or damaged. According to Ukraine's culture ministry, Oleksandr Tkachenko, 166 cultural heritage sites have been destroyed or damaged during the Russian invasion. Quote, we don't know about some of the objects yet because they are in the occupied territories. There is evidence, and we are verifying the data. It is obvious that we are talking about reparations and restoration of the damaged sites by the aggressor state, he said. According to Tkachenko, one second. According to Tkachenko, his ministry was negotiating with Western partners to create a joint fund to restore Ukrainian cultural heritage. Ukrainian Marines are in Mariupol, say they're running out of ammunition. A social media post from Ukrainian Marines reports a critical situation in the southern port of Mariupol besieged by Russian forces since March 1. Today, we will probably be the last battle as the ammunition is running out. The 36th Marine Brigade of the Ukrainian Armed Forces said on Facebook the post was not an official position of the brigade, but a letter from one of its officers. It's death for some of us and captivity for the rest, he added, saying that the brigade had been surrounded by the Russian army and a half of the Marines were wounded. The Marine Brigade is one of several Ukrainian units defending Mariupol. Kremlin has said that Finland and Sweden are joining NATO will not bring stability to Europe. We have repeatedly said that the alliance remains a tool geared towards confrontation and its further expansion will not bring stability to the European continent, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov had said. A senior U.S. State Department official said last week that Finland and Sweden's NATO accession was discussed at a meeting of the alliance's foreign ministers in Brussels. Both countries stayed neutral during the Cold War, then joining the European Union as a political union in 1995, but not the NATO, a military alliance. Russia says it destroyed Ukrainian missile defense system. Russia said it has destroyed S-300 anti-aircraft missile systems, which had been given to Ukraine by a European country. Russia did not say which European country supplied Ukraine with the system. Russian launched caliber cruise missiles on Sunday against four S-300 launchers, the defense ministry in Moscow said. According to the ministry, the system on the outskirts of the Ukrainian city of Dnipro was destroyed and 25 Ukrainian troops were hit in the attack. Slovakia, which had donated a S-300 missile system to Ukraine, said that the one it supplied had not been destroyed. A group of French technical and scientific gendarmes or police had arrived in Ukraine to investigate potential war crimes by Russian soldiers in Kyiv suburbs. The French ambassador to Ukraine, Etienne de Ponsin, wrote on Twitter. According to him, France is the first country to provide such assistance to Ukraine. The police will start their work on Tuesday. Bucha and other small towns near Kyiv became the site of atrocities during the Russian occupation. After the retreat of Russian troops, Ukraine said hundreds of corpses were found in the streets and houses, as well as in mass graves. Zelensky tells South Korea Mariupol had been destroyed. Addressing the parliament of South Korea, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that the worst situation was currently in Mariupol. This port city in southern Ukraine has been besieged by Russian troops since the 1st of March. Mariupol has been destroyed. There are tens of thousands of dead. But even despite this, the Russians are not stopping their offensive, Zelensky said in a video address. He said that Russia had destroyed hundreds of pieces of infrastructure all over Ukraine, including at least 300 hospitals. Ukraine president also accused Russian soldiers of looting. They tried to take home everything of any value, from washing machines to computers, from auto parts to clothes, Zelensky said. He cited cases of Russian soldiers removed protective plates from their bulletproof vests to hide stolen laptops and tablets. According to Zelensky, Russia is now concentrating tens of thousands of soldiers for its next offensive, meaning that Ukraine needs more help to survive this war. We need air defense systems, jets, tanks, artillery, and ammunition. You have them, Zelensky told politicians in Seoul. He also called on the world to impose even more sanctions on Russia to force the aggressor to stop the war. And German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock of the Greens has called for Ukrainian forces to be sent additional weapons in light of horrific images coming out of Bucha and other towns in the country. Now is not the time for excuses, but creativity and pragmatism, Baerbock said during a Monday meeting of European Union foreign ministers in Luxembourg. So Baerbock stressed that Ukraine needs, quote, above all, heavy weaponry, end quote. Defense Minister Christine Lambrecht of the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, had earlier said it would be difficult to supply Ukraine with further weapons and materials directly from Bundeswehr stocks without jeopardizing Germany's own defense capabilities. So, well, supposedly Ukraine is planning 9 humanitarian corridors. Ukrainian government said it has set up 9 humanitarian escape routes with the goal of evacuating civilians from cities in the eastern part of the country. Fighting is expected to intensify in the country's east following Moscow's announcement that Russian forces will force their efforts on securing the region. One route will allow private vehicles to travel from the besieged southeastern city of Mariupol to Zaporizhia, Ukrainian Deputy Prime Minister Irina Vereshchuk had said. So Vereshchuk added that there will be escape routes from the coastal city of Berdyansk and 2 other cities in Zaporizhia region. 5 corridors lead from contested areas in the eastern Luhansk region to the eastern city of Bakhmut. Vereshchuk said around 2,800 people had managed to flee contested areas on Sunday. So that's the story. We are down to the last 40-some-odd seconds. So we're going to need to say goodbye back to our studio screen. So thank you again for joining us today. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Oh, yeah, tomorrow we're going to be speaking to Jeff Swartz and Professor Beery. And we're going to talk to them probably about what's going on I'll find out later. I'm too stressed out. Well, there we are. So that's the end of the day. Take care and goodbye. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.